Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to the New Books Network and the New Books of Military History channel. This is your host, Bob Wintermute. Conventional wisdom has long held the position that between 1945 and 1949, not only did the United States enjoy a monopoly in atomic weapons, but that it was prepared to use them if necessary against an increasingly hostile Soviet Union. This was not exactly the case, according to our guest, John M. Curatola, author of Bigger Bombs for a Brighter Tomorrow, The Strategic Air Command and American War Plans at the Dawn of the Atomic Age, 1945 to 1950. John, who is a professor of history at the United States Army Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, presents the story of an ad hoc, frequently chaotic strategic defense posture at the opening of the Cold War. Inter-service rivalries, inter-agency bickering, and deficiencies in equipment, morale, and training all left the United States Air Force and the Atomic Energy Commission to pursue their own strategic plans, which John notes were unrealistic and in some cases almost ludicrous. John, thank you for joining us at New Books in Military History.
I'm glad to be here, Bob. Thank you.
First, I got to give a disclosure for this interview. The views expressed in this interview in no way reflect upon the current official policy of the Department of Defense, the United States Command and General Staff College, the Atomic Energy Commission, or the United States Air Force. The opinions they share with us today are wholly your own, correct?
Correct.
Well, it hasn't been often that we've hosted authors who focus on atomic strategy. You know, I must admit, it's something of an oversight on my part. You know, I've been fascinated with the subject since the early 1980s. How is it you came to this project?
Well, during my graduate studies, working on my dissertation, I found this disconnection between the Air Force, the Atomic Energy Commission, and this lack of realistic planning through my research and writing the dissertation. And the book itself is one chapter out of my dissertation that I blew up to provide, you know, more in-depth coverage of this topic in this particular area. I just kind of stumbled across it in the course of my regular dissertation writing.
Well, many people who have written on the subject have been compelled to make a choice between emphasizing either the scientific technological aspects of the bomb and its creation, or the policymakers' emphasis on strategic necessity after August 1945. You've presented more of a synthesis between the two. Now, I won't dispute the necessity of that, but again, I want to ask, how did you come to that decision?
Yeah, what I found was there's this disparate efforts that were going on between the Atomic Energy Commission and the Air Force. As you know, the Air Force comes into its own during the Second World War, while strategic bombing didn't necessarily unfold the way the framers envisioned it would through the look at the strategic bombing survey done in 1945-1946. However, with the advent of atomic energy and the atomic bombs, this kind of recalibrates Air Force bombing doctrine, the fact that now one aircraft carrying one bomb can have decisive effects as opposed to a whole air division dropping thousands of tons from, you know, hundreds of airplanes. And so there's a change in thought process about the application of strategic bombing. Mm-hmm. Along the same lines, it is recognized early on that there should be a civilian organization, which becomes the Atomic Energy Commission, that should be in control of fissionable materials and production and research, only because that they felt it was necessary to have this civilian oversight for such dangerous materials. And what you have is two organizations that are not talking to each other, that have very different opinions regarding nuclear applications, production, storage, and use of such weapons.
Well, you know, many young people, and to be honest, not so young too, I think are either unaware that the United States Air Force's Strategic Air Command existed, or conversely, that it has been defunct since 1991.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I remember it as perhaps a central symbol of American strategic deterrence. You know, before we turn to its origins, what do you think of this lack of a historical awareness of Strategic Air Command? What does it mean for us today?
Well, I think what it means is when you look, quite frankly, at some of the faux pas that the Air Force has experienced in the past few years with this lack of focus on strategic application and, quite frankly, nuclear application, you have a breakdown in command and control, a breakdown and responsibility, and with some of the recent events we've had where nuclear weapons have been flown across the country, and nobody knew that they were flown. So you have an atrophy with regard to this particular endeavor, because we think we're beyond it now. That, you know, the Soviet Union went away, we won the Cold War, and who's going to apply nuclear war now? Well, I think that there's a realization now that with North Korea, a resurgent Russia, China flexing its muscles a little bit, that maybe, you know, we're not out of that nuclear footlocker quite yet, and that this needs to be revisited. How, at the same token, the fact that much of your nuclear arsenal is now also getting old, to include, you know, your weapons or bombs, and that needs to be recapitalized as well. And so there does need to be a refocus on this to make sure that America maintains at least its parity, if not its superiority, in this kind of application.
Well, let's turn to 1945. You know, so much of the existing state of America's atomic arsenal at the end of the Second World War, you know, the fact that there was no effective backup, the fat man and little boy, if needed, you know, the slow pace of constructing a new device, et cetera, you know, and other factors. This is all now well known. But what was the general perception that you found of America's atomic power then?
Most people felt, well, there was some hand-wringing amongst the American population, you know, just a few months after Nagasaki and Hiroshima about, you know, should we have dropped these weapons? Are these amoral weapons? You know, and as you well know, in August of 1945, there was not a lot of moral qualms over dropping these devices. Get the war over as soon as possible.
Yeah, and Truman didn't have any qualms at all.
No, you point not, that not out at as all. Well. Yeah, none at all. But what you see subsequent to these events, then you start seeing kind of a hand-wringing about, you know, these kinds of applications. And that also helps facilitate this transition to civilian control of atomic weapons, the Atomic Energy Commission. And so what you see here is, as America, as it also demilitarizes from the Second World War and demobilizes basically 11 million men, we have these atomic weapons now that can serve as our deterrent shield now. Since we have the monopoly, nobody's going to, you know, encroach on American interests because we are the sole stakeholder in this atomic technology. Now, most Americans or most strategists understood that the Russians were going to break this monopoly, that they were going to develop nuclear weapons all by themselves. The question was, to when and what extent? And that was really the question mark that was going on at this time. But until then, America felt relatively safe with its atomic monopoly. The problem was it was largely a paper tiger than anything of substance.
Were the Soviet Union and America's allies aware of these gaps between rhetoric and reality?
Soviet Union, no. I don't think the American people or the most of the American defense industry are those involved within the Department of Defense or National Military Establishment, as it was known back in 47, were even aware of it because nobody was talking to anybody else. The war was over. The military was downsizing. And there was very little interest in developing nuclear technology subsequent to the war. As a matter of fact, Leslie Groves, who's in charge of the Manhattan Engineering District, as he's transitioning that program over the Atomic Energy Commission, he has to divest himself of a host of equipment and personnel to downsize the atomic program since the, because the war is over. And so as a result, nobody is really coordinating, okay, the atomic effort between the military and the Atomic Energy Commission. And the Atomic Energy Commission is headed by a gentleman who is very anti-military. He is very suspect of the military mind, and as a result, is loath to cooperate with the military in any large-scale fashion.
Yeah, you mentioned James Lilienthal. That's who the head of the Atomic Energy Commission is at the start. Yeah. You know, many people overlook the fact that it was born from this civil-military dilemma, and it was originally largely oriented as a defense entity.
Yes.
You know, What's the story of the creation of the Atomic Energy Commission? And more to the point, you know, how do you get someone like Lilienthal, who is so, I'm not going to say anti-military, but certainly skeptical and fearful of the military, having control of this device?
Yeah.
How does he become the head of the AEC?
It's interesting. That's a great question. They interview him while he is a lead candidate for it, and they ask him if he is if he feels qualified. And his response is, hell no, nobody's qualified for this job. So, you know, to start off on that note, however, what he has done, he was chairman of the Tennessee Valley Authority, so he is familiar with large technical endeavors. You know, he does have capability and leadership in regards to scientific endeavor, engineering endeavors, and that's one of the reasons he's put in place, because he's overseen the TVA for so many years.
Well, how prepared were the planners and senior leaders of the Army Air Force and later the United States Air Force for the potential realities of atomic warfare? Do they really understand its potential and its hazards?
No, very poor. What happens is, while we certainly look at the atomic explosions in Hiroshima and Nagasaki through scientific application, but it's largely done through a more engineering measurement of blast radius and effects, as opposed to a military lens looking at what can these things be used at, how should they be used, what targets should they be used at, any kind of real synthesis regarding potential applications in the future. And when the Atomic Energy Commission sponsors the Crossroads tests later on, those are largely science experiments, testing the effects of weapons, radiation, fallout. But none of that information that is collected from those sandstone tests is shared with the Air Force. Atomic Energy Commission holds on to this information, claims it's top secret, and it's now compartmentalized. So the gentlemen who are supposed to be doing the planning for these war plans don't have access to this test material because it's compartmentalized. And so they have very little idea regarding specifics about these particular weapons and what they can do.
Well, you know, it's another factor you point out too, or you allude to, which is, you know, I think many people assume that war planning, you know, even atomic war planning, occurs in a vacuum and it's cut off from other more mundane considerations. But that's not the case. I mean, you describe, you know, the issues of budgetary constraints. You know, how much of this was, you know, taking place with the impact and the influence of external domestic considerations?
Let me go back to the national concerns as you start off in your comment there. One of the problems you have with the war plans there is the military planners don't have any guidance from strategic leaders, whether it be the president, vice president, the joint chiefs. If a war was to come, what do you want us to do with these weapons? What is the ultimate end state? Is it to make Russia a smoking irradiated ruin at the end of 2 hours? Or is it to provide some kind of a threat, a deterrent? Is it to provide limited damage to facilitate, you know, ground movement? None of this kind of guidance has been articulated either from the State Department or from the Truman administration. And there are those within the Air Force who are asking this question. You know, what do you expect us to do? And in my critique of this war planning that goes on subsequent to the World War is that these men are victims of their own success. And what I mean by that is rubble equals success. If I can level a city, that must mean that I was effective and therefore I can win the war. I think that that because of their success in the Second World War, they are blind to the nuances of this new application. So to start off looking at the national level, we need to put, you know, some onus on the Truman administration and the senior leaders and the State Department not providing these planners with that kind of guidance. Now, getting to the internal domestic factors, what you look at is, you know, as America downsizes, it cuts the budget for defense spending. What happens is all the services, Army, Navy, and the Air Force, which, of course, is going to become its own entity in 1947, now they're all vying for defense dollars because they know that what the Truman administration is focused on a balanced budget. And so with that balanced budget, they're going to be cut down to about $14 billion for the national military establishment. And what that means is that they're going to have to scale back. And as they see the emerging threat of the Soviet Union, the question is, well, who's going to get what part of that pie? And the argument from the Air Force is, in this nuclear, air-centric world that we live in now, we're the big stick. We're the ones that are going to take it to the Russians. The armies are going to secure bases. That's about all we need them for anymore. The Navy, well, the thing is that the Russians don't have a large Navy. And so the naval threat really isn't one. And so from the Air Force's point of view, this air-centric, atomic-centric war is really where we ought to put our defense dollars. Now, if you're an Army chief of staff or the chief of naval operations, you're going to take umbrage with this Air Force air power centric thought process. And this is going to continue on all up into even the Eisenhower administration and the ideas of the new look in NSC 162.
Well, you know, you mentioned the strategic leader's role. And of course, at the top of the ladder or where the buck stops is with Harry S. Truman. And you know, he had clear views on the use of the atomic bomb as a weapon, you know, not specifically just about seeing their use in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but the system as a whole in peacetime. You know, what were his views and how did they not filter down to the Air Force?
Yeah, it's interesting. What's happening subsequent to the war that there are one of the things that's underpinning a lot of the thought of the Truman administration is that the American economy, its way of life, all these things that underpin, you know, our affluent lifestyle subsequent to the war, that's our real strength. And if we outspend ourselves defensively and undermine our economy, that's what the Russians really want. So the thought process at the time was, hey, let's minimize defense spending, balance our budget, return to a peacetime economy where we're focusing on large appliances and cars and those kinds of things, consumerism in its finest form, and we'll minimize defense expenditures and we'll put money in this atomic endeavor. But again, you have this argument between the various services over how much of that defense pie should be divvied out. The Air Force has a number of studies that are done in Congress that advocate a 70-group Air Force to conduct this kind of deterrence defense missions. Problem is they're not funded for 70 groups. And this gets to be an argument, you know, between the services as I talk about the rivalries with regard to the Beltway isn't built yet, but these Beltway discussions that occurred during this time.
Well, we know about what will happen in 1949 with, you know, the revolt of the admirals and
right.
such. And I'm just jumping ahead a bit. That's an example, of course, though, of the inter-service rivalry that you're describing. It really was that serious, wasn't it?
It was. There's some works out there already, Jeffrey Barlow's book, but it's very serious. And there's some subterfuge that goes on. There are false accusations that are printed that are sent out to members of Congress and the press. There's congressional inquiries. And then there's testimony in October in 1949 that generals and the admirals basically plead their case to Congress regarding naval aviation or strategic bombardment as the way forward for American defensive postures. And what happens is the Navy loses, and it loses badly to the Air Force. And as a matter of fact, the Chief of Naval Operations is fired as a result. Many members of the cell that did a lot of the research regarding nuclear applications within the Navy, those guys are reassigned. Some of them are fired. So you do have, it's a very nasty tooth and nail fight between the services, to include articles being run in the Saturday Evening Post and various other civilian periodicals where they are advocating, the Navy and the Air Force both advocating to the American public directly their positions. And it gets so bad that the Secretary of Defense actually has to get involved, James Forrestal, and tell him, stop it. Anything that's going to come out of the Department of Defense must clear my office before it goes up, because he gets so tired of them bickering at each other in various venues.
Well, we're going to shift gears a minute. You know, what was the Baruch plan? You know, I mean, you and I know what it is, but for our listeners, and how does it shape relations between the new Atomic Energy Commission and the Department of Defense?
What happens is when the Atomic Energy Commission gets established with the McMahon Act, what happens is all the nuclear fissionable materials are supposed to be given to the Atomic Energy Commission for storage, for safekeeping, and for future research. But here's one of the problems you have is the Manhattan Project, which, of course, was the wartime project that was going on to make Fat Man and Little Boy. Most of those scientists, the long hairs, as they referred to them, they went home. They went back to academia and continued their lives. And when you have this exodus of the brain drain, if you want to use that term, it creates a lot of chaos within the Atomic Energy Commission because nobody's around now. A lot of these smart guys have left. And they have a bunch of components of various bombs, and it's so bad that some of the people that remain, because the project was so compartmentalized, have all these bits and pieces of bombs, and they don't even know what bomb they go to. They have notes from some of these scientists, but again, these are just notes. There's no printed, approved manual on how to make a fat man, how to assemble a fat man. Because this was such an ad hoc experimental application during the war for, you know, expeditious use, that nobody bothered to put this stuff down in formal writing. So there was a lot of reconstruction that has to go on regarding how these things work, how they're put together, and which parts go to where. So you have a complete problem with regard to managing these assets, managing these people, and with the brain drain of these scientists, there is also a morale problem at Los Alamos, a loss of purpose, if you will, because they were all fighting for the war for good reasons, but now that expediency is gone. And so there is a huge morale problem. And plus, Los Alamos, if you've ever been there, is very as a remote site. So it's not necessarily a garden spot if you have a wife and some kids and you don't know what your next job is.
How prepared was the United States for a potential crisis that could escalate into a scenario that would include using the atomic bomb before 1950?
Yeah, hardly. As best as I can find, because there are, in the course of my research, I still found a lot of redacted poor reports, you know, that still are classified to this day for, you know, whatever reason. But as best as we can tell, 1947, that's the first time Harry Truman actually gets a report regarding the number of atomic bombs that is in the U.S. arsenal. So this is 2 years after the war. And it isn't until then that he gets a report. Now, the report, when you find it in the archives, the number of bombs is blank. It's given to him orally. Now, supposedly, as best as we can tell, the number of bombs on hand for the Americans is 6, to the best of our abilities, what we can find. Because we launched 2 during the crossroads test. So we had 8 minus 2 leaves us 6. And supposedly, when Truman learns about this, according to those who were there, he turned gray. And on top of that, if I mean to be more specific, you have components for 6 bombs. You don't have 6 bombs. Because the shelf life of a fat man bomb is only about a week.
Was that the main reason for the bottleneck, or were there other factors?
It's a reason for the bottleneck. Plus, it takes about 48, 72 hours for a trained bomb crew to build the bomb. The lenses that provide the implosion for Fat Man are literally glued into place by hand. And this has to be done by a specially trained crew. Now, you have to have batteries that will help keep the initiating charge alive. Well, the thing is, the plutonium emits so much radiation that it not only degrades the battery life, but it also degrades
the initiators for the explosion. So after about a week, you got to take the whole bomb apart and replace everything. And again, back to the 72-hour window. And of course, to build these bombs, you have to have certain power requirements. You have to have, you know, a place to actually build them. Well, here's the problem. If you're going to conduct an atomic bombing campaign, you need the range to do that. The problem is none of our bombers can really fly that far at this time. We don't have intercontinental bombers as we would do that today. We have the B-29, but it still has to fly from a forward base. What that means is you have to assemble the bomb forward, then load it up in the aircraft, and then fly it forward.
Well, that comes to my next question, you know, which is, you know, a good part of the story here is the Air Force's quest for this reliable delivery system. You know, how does the Air Force get from the B-29 Superfortress to the B-52 Stratofortress platforms? I mean, there are several marks and models there.
Absolutely. The B-29, of course, you know, the firebombing of Japan, and the B-29 has a number of teething problems, you know, early on in its operation. As a matter of fact, its teething problems regarding the engines and the pressurization systems and the meteorology that affected it forces LeMay to go from high altitude to low altitude, which results in the Tokyo firebombing and the things that you see happening over Japan in this spring and summer of 1945. The thing is that standard B-29 can't carry a fat man or little boy bomb. You have to have a specially configured B-29 to have the lifting shackles and sway bars to hold a 10,000-pound bomb in its bomb bay. So what happens is the U.S. Air Force builds what's called silver plate bombers. These are specially configured B-29s. They have some water injection in them. They have the defensive armament removed. They have electronic doors as opposed to pneumatic bomb bay doors. There's a number of modifications to the silver plate B-29s because they have to fly a very specific profile to get out of the way of the atomic blast. They have to execute a 180-degree turn, you know, and dive away, which is a violent maneuver for an aircraft that big. After the war, the number of silver plate B-29s that the U.S. has on hand is about 24, ballpark figure. And by 1947, they are described as being rather war-weary. Yeah. So the aircraft that the U.S. has to even deliver this weapon, they're already in bad shape. And I didn't even address the crews themselves. It's one thing to have the weapon system. Do you have crews that can deliver this weapon in a professional, competent manner? And the Air Force is severely lacking that skill set as well.
And of course, all this presumes that the United States is going to achieve air supremacy in any conflict with the Soviet Union.
Absolutely. And that's another problem, if you go back to the war plans a little bit, in that we have no idea, or I'm going to back up, I'll change that. We have very little credible evidence regarding target sets within the Soviet Union at this time. The only way the U.S. is getting any intelligence about target sets within the Soviet Union itself is by conducting interviews with POWs who were either in the Gulag or who were in various places within the Soviet Union who were forced laborers. And so what happens is the U.S. takes that intelligence and starts building their target list. Now, the question is, you know, 3 or 4 years later, is that still a viable target? Is that still there? Are they still making tanks there? And so the problem is the U.S.'s intel regarding specific targets is sketchy at best. And we won't start getting, you know, spies into the Soviet Union and satellites until much later into the 1950s. But this particular project, Project Ringer, interviews thousands of POWs who were sitting in the Soviet Union. And that's how we're developing our target lists and what the Germans were telling us from their experiences on the Eastern Front during the war. So our target sets, you know, at best are specious. Now, having said that, and getting back to your point, Bob, the Soviet air defense system, we know very little about. We know that they have some technology they got from us Lend-Lease and that they have modified some of their radar sets, you know, and we know that they do have, you know, some interceptors. But what we are also realized now is they have this new thing called the MiG-15, a new jet interceptor. But again, how many do they have? How many are in sector? What are their radar capabilities? That is a big question mark that nobody can really answer at this time. So the crews themselves are flying into the unknown, not only in terms of target set, but in terms of Soviet defensive capabilities.
Yeah, obviously, this is all the result, I would say, in part of the Air Force's obsession with its wartime strategic bombing campaign. Other historians have noted that the subsequent assessment of the air war against Germany and Japan, the strategic bombing survey, was inconclusive, if not directly critical, when it came to the Army Air Force's planning and execution.
Yeah.
And further, as you say, every analyst recognized from what little they knew that the Soviet Union's air defense capability was far greater than that of the Axis powers after 1945.
And you think about the fact that the Soviet Union is 63 times bigger than Greater Germany.
Yeah, I mean, was all this, reliance on the strategic bombing survey as inspiration for the planning between 1946 and 1950? Was this a case of cognitive dissonance, or was it a veiled effort to achieve greater public support?
Yeah, here's the truth. As you correctly identified, the bombing survey, I always tell my students, is kind of like the Bible. You can interpret it any way you want. It worked or it didn't work. It's very ambiguous as far as I'm concerned. If you're pro-Air Force, you could say it validated it. Now, I agree with you that it at best worked marginally, at best. However, if you're in the United States Air Force or Army Air Forces in 1946, and you read the bomber survey, your mouth is agape. You don't believe it. There is no way in their minds that strategic bombing didn't work.
Yeah.
There was quite a bit of controversy over the bombing survey when it comes out. If you're wearing an Army Air Forces uniform, they won the war. That is their mindset. And so when you look at the Air Force's planning factors and how they viewed their role in the war, they discount much of what the USPOS says, and that what they'll argue is they're not taking everything into account. They're not looking at the secondary and tertiary effects of what we did.
Which wouldn't matter in an atomic war anyway.
Yeah. What they're saying is now we have atomic weapons, and so that changes the application, with one bomb, one aircraft, but the idea is still good because look what we did to Germany in the Second World War, despite what the USPOS says. Mm-hmm. So again, if you're in the Air Force in 1946 and 47, we won the war. End of story.
How does all this fit into the war plans that David Allen Rosenberg described in that 1983 article? The article, for those who aren't familiar, it's titled "The Origins of Overkill: Nuclear Weapons and American Strategy, 1945 to 1960.
Yeah, and that's a great read as well. He did yeoman work with that. Here's the problem: is you go back to these ideas of the target sets. What are we blowing up, and why are we blowing it up? What is your end state? What do you hope to achieve with this bombing effort? And as I said before, you don't have any kind of input from the National Security Council or from the strategic leadership as to what you expect these war plans to accomplish. And so what the Air Force does, and going back to what I mentioned a little bit earlier, was they're victims of their own success, if you want to use that term, that we can blow these cities up. There is now recognition that a city is nothing more than a collection of industry. That's kind of how they determine it now. And so what they fully expect is we're going to hit these cities, we're going to smash the Soviet Union's industrial capacity, and they'll just capitulate. End of story. And now it's a very simplistic way of looking at war. But again, how they looked at it is because we have an atomic monopoly, this will drive the Soviets to their knees. However, there were those that are going to say, all you're going to do is prove to the Soviets that we're barbarians, and you're just going to upset them even more. And they're not going to quit. They didn't quit with the Nazis, and they're not going to quit with us.
Which was the underlying unspoken moral or lesson behind a strategic bombing survey as well.
Yes. Yeah, because as you saw in the bombing survey, it says morale never dropped. Of course, it's a totalitarian government, which what the Soviet Union is as well. What choice do you have? I guess I better go to work today. I don't have any choices. And so this is where you get, as you pointed out, some of that cognitive dissonance between, well, this really didn't work, but there's no reason not to try it again, you know? You do have this kind of false dilemma or this dichotomy going on here. And keep in mind, too, it isn't just all nuclear. They also planned on a conventional campaign as well to work in unison with nuclear applications. What's interesting, though, is, as you mentioned, these early war plans are talking about dropping dozens and then hundreds of atomic weapons over the Soviet Union at a time when I just told you, in 1947, we have parts for six. So this is a direct example of how the war plans aren't even reflective of what the U.S. arsenal looks like, because the military doesn't even know how many bombs there are.
Well, that kind of answers the question I was going to bring up, which was, you know, what condition is Strategic Air Command in when it's established? Which is not very good.
No, it's not. Because, and like in most wars, everybody wants to go home. And, you know, this is before you had a large standing military in the United States. And most of the men who served in the Army and the Navy all wanted to go home and have children and carry on with their lives. And what you have with this demobilization, as one Air Force leader calls it, a riot, really, everybody leaves, to include those trained, quality, smart, you know, experienced air crews, and I may say maintainers, the guys who fix airplanes. A lot of those guys leave. And many who stay or become assessed into the Air Force or to the military are not, well, I'll say it, they're the dregs. They're not that bright. They don't have a lot of future. So they stay in the military. And in the book, I talk about some of the test scores, assessments for maintainers as they come into the Air Force. And keep in mind, as we progress from the Second World War, the airplanes get more complex, bigger, jet engines require more maintenance, cost more. But yet the maintainers and the pilots aren't of the kind of caliber you would want to have in your nuclear force. And so you also have a problem not only with the airplanes themselves getting old, as I pointed out with the silver plate bombers, but the pilots and the maintainers themselves are subpar.
Well, it's also a question of leadership, too. I mean, people think of Strategic Air Command, and they those who do think about it immediately turn to Curtis LeMay as, you know, the flamboyant, aggressive commander who advocated bombing his enemies to the United States enemies to the Stone Age much later during the Vietnam War. But when the Strategic Air Command is first created, it's led by the former Southwest Pacific Air Commander, General George Kenney. How does Kenney compare with LeMay?
Kenney has a great wartime record, you know, being Douglas MacArthur's, you know, Air Commander for 5th Air Force. And he has a great reputation coming out of the war. The problem is he starts to become enamored with his celebrity to a large degree.
Well, he comes from MacArthur's command, so you can see where that would rub off.
Yeah, you can see that rubbing off on him. But there's this idea subsequent to the war of developing a world air force. And, of course, this is when we're still debating whether or not we're going to give up our nuclear secrets and make them available to the world, under the idea that if everybody knows about it, nobody will build them and we won't go down that road. Of course, we don't go down that road. However, George Kenney is still an ambitious officer. He sees that if they were to build this world air force, he would be in charge of it. And so he at first spends a lot of time in New York City, you know, when the UN moves there, working on this particular program. By October 1946, he kind of realizes this isn't going to happen, and he's lost interest. And so when he takes the helm of Strategic Air Command, he is now, you know, the lead officer for this new application, this new defensive shield for the United States. In that role, he is on the road constantly meeting people, pressing the flesh, making speeches, doing those kinds of things, and not tending to the store, as it were. And senior leadership within the Air Force start to notice this, that the big stick that we've created with Strategic Air Command is not operating at the competent level that we would expect it to be. And as a matter of fact, this becomes such a concern that the chief of staff of the Air Force, two spots, sends Charles Lindbergh and Paul Tibbetts to look at some of the Strategic Air Command units and make their own evaluations regarding SAC air crews and maintenance. And they both come back with the same observations. They say that the crews are overworked. The maintainers are overworked. You have poor morale, that the troops are not competent. And as a result, they realize that Keeney hasn't been minding the store. So in October of 1948, he is subsequently removed, and LeMay is put in charge to basically clean house. And he does. And that's when you start to see the growth of SAC, as you and I understand it, you know, from the history of the 50s and 60s, largely begins with LeMay.
Well, you also credit NSC 68 as a critical step in developing a reliable nuclear deterrent, largely or particularly in view of Truman's own fiscal conservatism and public skepticism of the need for this large military establishment. How does NSC 68 factor in to ensuring SAC takes place?
Great question. I will make the argument that the autumn of 1949 is a watershed event in the American military, because you sniff out Joe 1, beginning of September. The explosion's in August, but they sniff it out in the beginning of September. A month later, you have the establishment of the People's Republic of China. That's coming, you know, for years. We see it, the train coming, but on 1 October, Mao raises the flag over Tiananmen Square. That same month, you have the revolt of the admirals, the testimony that we talked about a little bit earlier. You also have, now that the Soviet Union has the atomic bomb, they may have this thing called a super bomb or a thermonuclear weapon. We understood the theory, or at least started developing the theory of thermonuclear weapons in 1945 with Edward Teller, but Oppenheimer told them, look, we don't have time to do that. We'll worry about it later. And as I told you before, nuclear research kind of goes on the back burner during this period. Now the question's being asked, if the Soviets have an atomic weapon, are they potentially working on a thermonuclear weapon? So that is being discussed in October and November, December 1949, as well as a discussion on increasing the nuclear stockpile that we have already, because our war plans don't match our inventory. And so you have a number of efforts or a number of events that are coming together that are intersecting here in this autumn period of 1945. And it's my argument that this period leads to a reassessment of American national security strategy, which results, of course, in NSC 68. NSC 68 has a price tag to it. If you want to do this kind of defensive posture, the military budget has to go from basically $14 billion annually to almost $48 billion annually. And of course, we know that after the North Koreans come across the border in the summer of 1950, Truman will sign NSC 68 in August of 1950, which of course puts more money back into the military coffers. And you'll see an exponential growth in the Air Force and competency. Your B-47s, your B-52s start coming out during this time as well. And of course, that gets superseded by NSC 162, the new look, which puts even more money and even more emphasis on strategic bombardment.
Well, you know, you mentioned the super, you know, which does change the calculus of atomic war planning taking place at Strategic Air Command. Was this viewed as an advantage or a detriment by American planners at the time, the need to develop the thermonuclear bomb?
Yeah, it's a great question, because there's a lot of hand-wringing that's going on between not only the Atomic Energy Commission and the General Advisory Board, but the military planners themselves wondering, well, when are you going to use this thing? You know, is this really a military weapon? Yeah. This is the debate. You know, one, is it moral? Okay, that's a whole other issue. But two, what kind of targets are you going to use this thing on? You've got, you know, megatons worth of destructive power. And it basically comes down to the argument that, look, if we don't develop these, they will. And we can't afford to let them have them, and we don't. So at the end of January 1950, when they finally bring the issue to Truman for decision, his response is, "What the hell are you waiting for? Yeah. You know, let's start this process." And so this is why this idea of bigger bombs, because we're going to need these things at least as a deterrent. And if we're going to use them, you know, they're going to use them on us. And so you start getting the mutual assured destruction, you know, and those things that come up that bloom a little bit later on in the 1950s. But this idea is, what are we going to do with these things? They're kind of confounded at this early stage with thermonuclear weapons. Of course, we haven't developed them yet. They're still theoretical. But at the time, what is its real use? They haven't figured that out yet, but they know that they can't afford not to have them.
Well, what about within the Atomic Energy Commission? I mean, there was pushback there as well, wasn't there?
There was. As a matter of fact, the commissioners of the Atomic Energy Commission were split 3-2 over should they or should they not. And there are those members of the Atomic Energy Commission who are pushing it, are writing to members of the Congressional Committee on Atomic Energy pushing this issue, even though three of the commissioners don't want to do this. And you have gentlemen like Isidore Rabi, Oppenheimer, and Enrico Fermi, who serve as advisors, saying, don't build these things. But again, once members of the Energy Commission start talking to members of Congress, it gains momentum over time.
Well, you bring the book to a close with this new optimism within Strategic Air Command as President Eisenhower's new look posture comes into shape. How exactly was this a departure, though, from the 1946 to 1950 policies?
Yeah, great question. Here's the deal. During that 45 to 50 period, the budgets themselves are basically looked upon as an even spread. If the budget was $14 billion, then each service gets, you know, basically $3.5 billion. There's some adjustments, but basically it's even spread across the board, okay? And, of course, the Air Force doesn't like that, as we discussed before. Now, when Eisenhower comes in, he is very concerned about defense spending and, you know, about the ideas of the, you know, nuclear or the industrial, military-industrial complex that he frames a little bit later on. But he's very concerned about military spending, and he wants to cut back on military spending because he thinks we're spending too much money. Well, what they actually put together is a think tank called Operation Solarium. You know, what should our defensive posture look like, you know, to save money but build it for the long term? Because under NSC 68, what we envision is that the Soviets will have a capability by 1953 to strike America with its bombers and atomic weapons. And so that's what you're kind of focusing on with NSC 68. However, with NSC 162, what Eisenhower's looking for is what he refers to as a floating D-Day for the long term. We can't spend ourselves into the ground expecting the Soviets to attack. We need to be more efficient with our dollars and build a defense posture that will work in the long run. And as a result, what they come to the conclusion is that means Strategic Air Command and atomic bombing is where we're going to put our dollars. And so the Air Force comes out on top because they see that as a more as a wiser way to spend their defense dollars for this long term. Now, the irony of it is they end up spending just as much money under NSC 162 as they did in NSC 68. But the idea here is now we're putting more and more money towards the Air Force at the expense of the Army and the Navy.
Well, we're closing at the end of the interview, John. What are you reading these days that you might want to share with our audience that you think is worthwhile?
This particular area, there's some great works out there from the Joint Office. And the history of the Department of Defense, it's called the early years, 1947 to 1950, gives a very good account, not just of this particular topic, but all the issues that are affecting the Department of Defense during this time and up to the Korean War. And so I've been looking at a lot of those lately because my next work, again, addresses this fall period. I just got done reading
a number of works regarding the Korean War, China 1945, doing some research on the American experience there and how we see Chiang Kai-shek. He's going to lose. We know this by, 46 and 47. But what do? He's fighting, Mao and the Red Army, and we can't stomach that. But we also know that Chiang Kai-shek has a number of issues regarding corruption and misappropriation of equipment and graft and corruption. But he's our guy. So I've been looking at these early Cold War era in support of this this next book that I'm hoping to get done within a year or so.
Well, John, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us at New Books in Military History.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
Absolutely. And for all of our listeners, and on behalf of the New Books Network, this is your host, Bob Wintermute, signing off. Thank you all for listening.